The Guardian.
Welcome to Football Weekly with me, Rob Curling, the show that's as James Richardson free as the primetime television schedules have been since 1999. James, if you're listening, I didn't write this. I'd never dream of bad-mouthing a fellow broadcaster. Anyway, in today's thrilling instalment of sport's most popular podcast, we'll look back at the weekend's FA Cup action, where Arsenal went out with a whimper and a team of uppity championship tykes put some Premier League aristocrats on their bikes. Our big cup runneth over as we preview the return of the Champions League with a fascinating list of last 16 fixtures featuring the cream of England and Scotland and Liverpool FC. We've got the latest from Italy, while Sid in Madrid has the lowdown on Real's latest defeat and Barcelona's dramatic late win at Zaragoza. And our near-Earth orbit panel of eggheads will lunge two-footed into your always welcome posts and queries. There's all this, plus a refreshingly conspicuous absence of lame James Richardson-inspired puns in the latest thrilling instalment of Football Weekly.
Stand by for Guardian Football Weekly.
In the pod today are Kevin McCarra.
Welcome back, Rob.
Thank you very much. Barry Glendenning.
Hi, Rob.
Paul Doyle.
Hi, Rob.
And who did write that stuff about James Richardson? Who shot J.R.?
I think it was Sean Ingle, but I can't remember his name.
And much as I'd love to give Ingle the credit for that, I wrote that.
I'm so sorry, Barry. I thought you might...
Ingle's not clever enough to write something that funny.
Had your touch.
Can we also not forget that the great Paolo Bandini is also with us today?
Hello.
Sorry. Who wrote the great Paolo Pelmi?
No, this is called an ad lib now. It just flowed rather well, I thought. If we sound a little distracted, audience, it's because we actually have the television on behind us with the FA Cup sixth round draw. So you'll know that this is being recorded at precisely 1:30, lunchtime Monday. But let's just have a look at the big news this weekend, which concerns a once mighty institution being knocked off its perch by a sprightly underdog. Enough about me taking James Richardson's place in the pod. On to Barnsley's shock 2-1 win at Anfield against Liverpool. Who would have believed it? Barry, did Benitez just get it wrong? I mean, a late substitution of Gerrard. It was an odd performance.
It was a very odd performance, a very odd team selection. And it was a sort of a freakish result, really, because Liverpool were the better team and missed a lorry load of chances, which, you know, normally they'd score one or two. But all credit to the Tykes. Barnsley deserved their win, and I don't know how worried Rafa Benitez is going to be about being knocked out of the cup. I don't think he cares too much about it, but it certainly won't please his paymasters.
I was going to say, can you really say that, given that they're not going to win the league, and are you just relying on them winning the Champions League?
The cup victory covered up for their failings in 2006. It gave them something to point to and say, I'm doing okay.
Can't just tell you, Man U have drawn Portsmouth in the quarterfinals of the Cup, Bristol Rovers against West Brom, and we're just waiting to see that Barnsley will take on Chelsea. Kevin, we wanted to talk to you about this anyway, but maybe now is the time that, you know, for once it looks that the big four aren't necessarily going to get their names on the trophy this year.
Well, I never realised how fondly we'd look back on Everton winning in 95 and a kind of nasty, growling final with Man U. Decided by Paul Ince's mistake to try and dribble down the wing and give the ball away to the Everton players. Anyway, getting back to the present day, since then the big four have won it and no one else. So much for romance, blah, blah, blah. But you kind of hope the more the big four get involved in the Champions League, the more they'll be drained in the FA Cup. Hasn't happened yet, and it's a bad draw for Portsmouth going to Old Trafford. I think Portsmouth are kind of interesting outside bet for the Cup, but their odds have lengthened somewhat today.
Yeah, a lot of people were talking up Portsmouth's chances, weren't they, of at least getting to the final, but as you say, that's looking tough.
I think they ought to have rigged the draw. It's not what's meant to happen. I hate these fair and free draws.
What would you like to see?
Well, I think Manchester United and Chelsea to sort of beat each other senseless over two games would be a good thing for football.
Yeah, well, indeed. With the other draw we've got to talk about, Barrow Cardiff is the other one, Bristol Rovers West Brom. So those shape up quite nice. I mean, so we will get a Championship side or a Bristol Rovers League One side into the semis. Stunning.
In a way, I'd say that sort of contradicts what was just said about there being a chance of not having one of the big four winning it this season, because as far as I can see, you know, you put another weak team in the semi-final they're going to have no trouble with, really. I just don't see who there's going to beat Man United or Chelsea, really. I mean, Portsmouth, again, you might have thought they had some chance if they'd come away at home, but they haven't got that either, so...
You can't really see Middlesbrough winning it either. I mean, they've improved a bit recently under Southgate, Gareth Southgate, but... not enough to take on Chelsea or Man United.
Can we just get back to Liverpool after a little interlude there for the cup draw? Because Liverpool fans were obviously appalled at their performance of their side on Saturday. There were protests in the stands, shouting to get, you know, that their American owners get them out and leave them alone, let them take over the club. Do you think they're venting their frustration at the right people?
I think it's quite intriguing to see if Liverpool fans on our blogs blaming Jamie Carragher for turning his back when Brian Howard scored the winning goal. In times gone by, they wouldn't even have dreamed of mentioning any little peccadillo in the part of a club hero like Carragher. So I think the blame is spreading more widely, and it should do. The owners may be disastrous and it may be bad in the long term, but they have given Rafael Benitez enough money to do better than this.
Do you think Benitez has still got the fans backing?
I think it's fading because they can't even look at the team and say, well, you know, they're playing sort of attractive, romantic football that augurs well for the future. It's been fairly grim. Rotation itself needn't necessarily matter. Manchester United do it all the time and beat Arsenal quite handily while changing their team. But I think for all the money that has been spent by Benitez, and it's reasonably substantial, the alternatives are not good. I know Kout scored at the weekend, but it's first in 14 or something, and Voronin looks at a price tag of nothing, look rather expensive. So I think the recruitment has not been brilliant.
There's a suggestion here that Benitez's ongoing rows with Hicks and Gillette could be rather a clever political move on his part because it masks his own failings and makes them the target of the fans' frustrations. Anything in that?
I don't know if Benitez is thinking engineering that as such, but certainly as a fringe benefit. But I think that's changing. I think there's a general annoyance with everything at the club, including Benitez, the team and the owners. You can't change them all, of course, and the easiest thing to change is always the manager.
Well, Liverpool have a chance to drag themselves out of it a bit this week in the Champions League. They're up against Inter, and in recent years, Paolo, Inter have looked about as comfortable in Europe as a UK Independence Party member in his string vest on the Côte d'Azur.
That has Ingle written all over it. I'm telling you that.
How do you know? I might have made that up. But Paolo, is this the year they can challenge for the Champions League more seriously, do you think?
I think some of the criticism of Inter in Europe is a little unfair because really, it's only been the last 2 years that Inter are the side that they are now under Mancini. You know, last season, with the opportunities that Calciopoli gave them basically to somewhat get a monopoly on the important players in Serie A like Ibrahimovic and Vieira, they are a different team. And I actually think they were quite unfortunate to lose to Valencia last year. They were good through two legs. They were a bit naive in their defending. They did waste some chances to put away the first leg, which, you know, ended up drawing 2-2. So I think that it is slightly unfair. But at the same time, there's just something a little bit... something about Roberto Mancini that doesn't quite fill me with confidence in Europe. I think he's still... you know, he's experimented a little bit this season with a sort of attacking trident, but he's very generally committed to his 4-4-2, and I'm just not sure that really gets you anywhere in Europe anymore.
And he has got this incredible squad, so if they fail, he'll get the blame. He'll surely get the sack unless there's something spectacular this season in the Champions League.
Absolutely. I mean, this year is, again, the squad's taken another massive leap on from last season, and I mean it's actually something which would counteract all the arguments that Benitez is rotating too much. You look at Inter, the top of their league, you've got Ibrahimovic, who's only played just over 2/3 of their games. You know, they've been able to rotate because they've got such a good squad. It's maybe just more of a question that Liverpool squad aren't good enough to rotate. Yes. But I think that's something that Inter have got going for them this season, is that they've had all these players who are going to be much more rested than a lot of teams are going to be able to afford to have them.
So both managers on Tuesday, short of confidence?
Oh, Mancini won't be short of confidence at all. Mancini will be fairly happy going into this one. But again, you know, if Inter were to lose this game, Moratti, the owner, has already come out and said he expects to see his team in Moscow. You know, he's offering unheard of bonuses for them. You know, he's offering them, I can't remember exactly how much it is now, it's something like
350,000
euros ahead for if they win it. But he's also come out and said, well, I expect to reach Moscow this year, so if they don't, you know, don't be surprised if Mancini, despite romping to two titles in as ridiculously emphatic a fashion as you can imagine, finds himself out on his ear this summer.
What are the Italian press saying about it, Paolo?
Do you know, there hasn't really been a lot of editorial comment this morning. I was just looking through everything, and I guess probably most of that's still to come tomorrow. I mean, I think the sense in Italy is that Inter are favourites, which, you know, makes sense. They won their group and they're doing so well at home. But there hasn't been a lot of real in-depth analysis of it this morning.
It does strike me, Paul, it's a bit like playing Valencia. Last year, I've been beaten an awkward team to play against, which is exactly what Liverpool are. This is probably not the ideal draw for Inter.
No, I think it's probably as bad a draw as they could have had, given they won their group. And, you know, a team that is struggling but always does well in Europe. Rafa Benitez, a manager who knows probably how to do exactly the sort of tactically cute things that maybe Inter... I mean, Inter this season, you know, they have played very well. In some games, they really have been just great to watch. But sometimes, you know, probably more than they've looked great, they've just looked like a collection of extremely talented individuals. And you just sort of always wonder with that, if you've got a manager like Benitez who, especially with a team that, you know, does seem to raise itself for these games, is capable of just being a little bit, as I say, cute, a little bit clever and closing them out.
But surely now is a brilliant time to face Liverpool. Like, I mean, they've been lurching from comedy crisis to comedy crisis this season. They're coming into this game on the back of total humiliation against Barnsley. They've not even the best team on Merseyside, let alone the best team in Europe. And Inter, I would expect them to win this tie comfortably.
And that's going to be the prevailing attitude. And that's almost part of the problem, I guess, is, you know, are Inter, despite the fact they've had such a bad time in Europe, coming into this a little bit too arrogant? I don't know if they really are, actually. I mean, I think there is such a sense of they've not done enough in Europe that maybe they won't. This is exactly what Liverpool, and it's the same as Milan, have done in Europe for the last few years, is not be that good at home and then find a way every time you come round to the Champions League fixtures to raise the game back up to the level they can attain. Yeah, it's possible that Liverpool come out and play like they did against Barnsley and get, you know, hammered. But and, you know, bear in mind, last time Inter came to England, they gave Arsenal a utter pasting. But, you know, we shall see.
But how much the advantage that they play the second leg at home, Inter?
It is a big deal. I mean, I think that was a big deal last year. Again, you know, Inter were much better at the San Siro against Valencia, and they maybe didn't make as much of their dominance in that game as they should have done, because they could have had the game. Really, I mean, I remember Crespo missed a couple of absolute sitters in that game. They could have had that game, the whole tie, out of sight in the first leg. And so this time they're going to know exactly what they have to achieve in that second leg. So, you know, that maybe gives them something to hold on to.
Indeed. Saturday night thumpings aren't unusual in Manchester, apparently. As anyone who's waited in a taxi rank at 2:30 in the morning will know to their cost. But no one quite expected Arsenal to be hammered the way they were. Kevin, you were at the game. Just how bad were Arsenal, or how disinterested were Arsenal?
Well, first of all, they were truly shocking, and 4-0 flattered them. I think Rooney alone could have made it 8-0 if he'd taken all his chances. And United were very good, but let's see that to begin with. But Arsenal were absolutely disgraceful. I mean, you get these people talking about Traore and Justin Hoyt, who admittedly were rubbish, but they are the fringe players and youngsters who got no help whatsoever. I don't think Gallas and Toure could have played worse under any circumstances. If you were a conspiracy theorist, you'd think they'd been bribed. They were just so dreadful.
Well, I mean, there was no chasing back, was there, at all? There was just... Kevin.
No, and Cesc Fabregas again. I know he's been about up and down this season, but I've never seen him as down as this. He could barely find a teammate with a pass. You wondered... it's as if once Manchester United went ahead, calculation was made, well, we're missing about four first-team players, our squad's not very deep, Premier League's more important, and they just virtually played out the remaining 90 minutes. I hardly recall Edwin van der Sar being involved for Manchester United.
Actually, just thinking of the Toure and Gallas thing, I remember I was talking to some Arsenal fans before the Blackburn game, and I was saying, you know, would you rather see Toure come back in unfit or Philip Senderos? You never know what you're going to get, and I think we've had the answer rather emphatically on Saturday. And rather a fit Philip Senderos than what we saw on that.
You wondered, why not play Toure at right back and play Senderos in the middle, and at least that way have a bit more experience in the back four?
But are we missing the point here? Did Arsenal want this, or did they want the FA Cup out of the way? Because do they now not have the advantage over United in that they have one less competition to think about?
I thought they were going to see how it went, and then if the game was going quite well, then try, but I think they capitulated once they realised it was a difficult match.
It's not really a new Wenger ruse. He's done this before in games against Man United in the FA Cup before, when he used to leave Henry out, and he just sort of sit there and think, well, we'll see how this goes, and if it goes close, then we'll send in Henry and see if we can win it, and if not, then we'll pretend it didn't matter that much, which is sort of the attitude you think he's taking now.
In all your years as a junior gunner, Paolo, have you ever seen a performance that bad from them before? I mean, it was almost as if they were drugged or something.
Yeah, Igor Stepanov has to get a mention here. That was the last time Arsenal played so badly, wasn't it? Well, 6-1 in 2001.
Yeah, I was very fortunate, I think, this season not to see the away game at Tottenham, so I can't really pass judgment on that. But they were really very, very bad. I mean, even the players like Fabregas, who you sort of expect to lift them a bit. There was just, I think in the first half, there was barely a pass on to, you know, to a man that actually got there. It was
stunning. I have to say, Phil, they were 10 times better in the 5-1 defeat. They really were. They posed an attacking threat at White Hart Lane.
It's like you said, Kevin, if they had lost 10-0 on Saturday, it wouldn't have been it was just poor finishing by United and Rooney.
By Rooney in particular. What's his problem with finishing? He's very bad at it.
I don't know. You'll have
to ask him that. What do you mean? Does he practice? He needs to practice.
I think he wanted to reinvent himself as a sort of deep lying midfield player. I'll just forget all that shooting nonsense.
Well, he shot plenty. Scuffed them wide.
Now, maybe on Saturday, he was meant to be centre forward. He seemed quite astonished to find himself there.
I noticed as well that Nani has been getting a hard time and did get a hard time for his showboating during the game when he ran along at full pelt and bounced the ball or headed the ball to himself about four times and then did some impromptu juggling on the hoof, there were a few very malevolent tackles went in after that, and they were the only sort of tackles any Arsenal players tried to put in the whole game.
I have to say, Arsenal deserved that. They deserved to be embarrassed.
On the blogs, Mikey Mike 2711, Gunners fan, I think, said Wenger got this so wrong. This will come back to hurt us, he thinks. United wanted it more. This will inspire them to believe that they can catch us. They looked down in the mouth last week, but have the bit between their teeth once again. Do you think Mikey Mike's got that about right, guys?
I think it depends how Arsenal respond in their next game. I mean, if Arsenal have two or three wins in the trot, United will again sense the difficulty of this. But but it's as much as Man U could hope for.
Yeah, well, Arsenal's next game is actually AC Milan, of course.
Oh, yes.
But I know what you meant.
I meant in the league, yeah.
Yeah, but that takes us on nicely, doesn't it? To AC Milan this Wednesday. And how do they approach that now? I mean, will Arsenal come out absolutely full of gusto because of their lackluster performance at the weekend?
Well, I mean, I think Arsenal will, as they did with the Tottenham game, hope to just shrug it off and keep rolling. I mean, there are players, you know, important players. I do think it's unfair on Traore and Hoyt to single them out. They were bad on the weekend, but everyone was bad on the weekend. But there are important players coming back. You're going to have Sanya back in the team. I don't know if Clichy is going to be back, but if he is, that's a massive difference at fullback. And it's going to be a very different Arsenal team. They might be fortunate against Milan in that Milan possibly now are down to their third choice goalkeeper after Kalac hurt his hand. And
their first two are pretty bad.
To be fair, Kalac has been doing a pretty good job since he's come in for Dida. And actually, the reports are mixed. Some people think he is going to start on the weekend. I'm particularly fond of Dida's latest mishap. I believe he was getting off the bench on Saturday to go in for half-time, and he possibly heard a Celtic fan running by the stadium outside, and Sivak seized up and had to be carried off on a stretcher despite having gone nowhere near the field. But
what happened? He was getting off the bench and he just collapsed.
His back seized up and they had to get a stretcher out to carry him off. He basically couldn't get up.
This has echoes of people trying to change channels with a remote control and spraying their back. Was that Rio Ferdinand or someone? And then tomato ketchup bottles on their feet, which is Dave Besson, I remember. So, guys, just quick little prediction then on how those two games will go, think?
My favourite one of those injuries is Richard Wright, who apparently fell out of the attic in his parents'
house. Oh, yes. That can be very dangerous. So, quick thought on those games?
I'm going to pick a draw between Liverpool
Good
and Inter, which I'm going to be. I would
get off that
will
fence.
Probably be incredibly dull and 0-0 now. And for Arsenal Milan, I'm going to say Arsenal take a 1-0 lead in second leg.
Paul, how do you see them?
I'll echo that Arsenal comment, but I think Inter have to beat Liverpool.
Okay, Kevin.
I think Liverpool will grind out an appalling 1-0 win over to Milan and be very, very pleased about it. Don't you sometimes think that Milan one day will be too old and Arsenal's all-round movement might expose it? I can see Arsenal winning maybe even 2-0.
I think the other thing with Milan is, since Christmas, they've come on this great run and everything's been going up. But a lot of that was on the back of this. It was genuinely, for all the ridiculous hype about it, it was genuinely on the back of Pato coming in and really inspiring something in their attack. And now he's injured again. And you've got Giardino and Inzaghi. And I know Inzaghi in Europe has this wonderful knack of shouting and scoring, but they just look a little bit blunt again all of a sudden, just the last couple of games.
Barry, quick prediction.
I think Inter will beat Liverpool and I think Arsenal will beat Milan.
Lovely, guys. Thank you very much. That's it for part one. Part two, we'll look ahead to Manchester United and Celtic, and we'll be hearing from Sid Lowe in Spain.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian. The Guardian's news podcast has changed. Guardian Daily is now available to download from first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday. You can listen to it on your way to work or make it the first thing you click on when you log on to your computer. Guardian Daily, the best news and analysis from The Guardian's top team of reporters and commentators.
Guardian Daily from guardian.co.uk.
This is Guardian Football Weekly.
Welcome back to the pod. Now, Manchester United go into their game against French champions Lyon full of confidence after their win at the weekend, but they've had a poor record since winning the Champions League in 1999, reaching the semi-finals just twice in the last 8 years. So, guys, how are Manchester United going to do? I mean, Lyon, possibly a weaker side than in their heyday?
Yeah, they're certainly more inconsistent than they have been for a while, and they have big defensive problems. They've just bought Jean-Alain Boumsong, ironically in a bid to remedy those problems. but he has looked characteristically erratic at the back, and Sébastien Schillaci alongside him hasn't been much better. The fullbacks, again, they have a variety of fullbacks, and none of whom have been entirely convincing this season. So defence isn't their forte, even though they do have Grégory Coupe back. But and Atam Ben Arfa, who's one of their star midfielders, an excellent player, has suggested that they're going to try. They've spotted that United like playing on the counter. So they're going to try to make it so that they can't play on the counter and force them to come forward and dominate the match. Doesn't appear to be a particularly good strategy given Lyon's defensive problems. But Lyon, on the other hand, are very good going forward and can hit on the counter with Ben Arfa and in particular Karim Benzema up front, who, as I've mentioned before, is an outstanding striker. And as he showed him against Rangers in the last match to get them to this stage, can pose any defence a problem all by himself. But you'd have to make United favourites simply because of Lyon's defensive problems.
Interesting, because I mean, Lyon have such a terrific record in their own league, although I gather their manager totally ripped into them at the weekend for losing to Le Mans.
Yeah, well, their chairman even. He ripped into the players and the manager, Alain Perrin. Yeah. For resting players a la Benitez, he rested them against Le Mans with a view to keeping Ben Arfa and Benzema in particular fit for the United game, and they lost to Le Mans as they had done previously in the Cup. For all their dominance in France recently, that they can't win the Cup. So they were knocked out by Le Mans and then beaten at the weekend, and their lead in the league is down to just 1 point over Laurent Blanc's Bordeaux.
Yeah.
So they haven't got, not everything is rosy there at the moment, but they do have the ability to beat United. But I think over two legs, United will score more than them simply because Lyon's defence is ropey.
United 11-2 second favourites
to win the Champions League.
Yeah.
I think they're an excellent bet to win the Champions League. They probably won't, but I wouldn't fault anyone for putting their money on them. Certainly not.
Well, you just sort of look around at the field this year, and again, it doesn't look like a field where any of the teams outside of England are really looking like stunning the obvious candidates. I mean, Inter have the question marks over them in Europe. Roma, I very much can't see going far. Milan, again, you always say it, and maybe you get proved wrong again, but they do look old. And I think, you know, Real Madrid and Barcelona, I think Sid's going to be on in a minute and can tell us more. But neither of them look like they're blowing teams away to me this season. And you know, it seems like there is an opportunity there for any of the English sides who really, if they get their act together, to kick on.
Well, let's get Sid on the line, shall we, and see what he's got to say about all this. Sid, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, Rob Curling here. I'm afraid that other chap couldn't make it this week. But so we've just been talking about the Champions League, but just before we go on any further about that, in terms of the Spanish title, that's very much back on again, isn't it, now that Real Madrid losing ground at the weekend and Barcelona winning?
Yeah, it is back on, and the sort of, if you like, the kind of psychological makeup of the two teams has really changed. Going into this weekend's games, Real Madrid had the opportunity to go 11 points clear at the top of the table. They were playing Betis, who were obviously struggling against relegation, while Barcelona were going away to Zaragoza, a place where they've traditionally struggled to get results and a very good side. But Real Madrid were beaten 2-1 with two almost identical goals, two headers over Marcelo, their left back, who's possibly the worst left back in Spain at the moment. And having lost one there, then Barcelona went into their game against Zaragoza, played very well in the first half and 1-0 up, but then Zaragoza brought it back 1-1. and Fatagotta were all over them. And then with 10 minutes to go, the referee gave a completely awful penalty decision to completely gift Barcelona a penalty that never was, and they won 2-1. And as you can imagine, everyone in Madrid's jumping up and down and talking about conspiracies again.
Ah, so what's the gap now? 5 points at the top, is it?
The gap is now 5 points at the top of the table. And as I say, psychologically, this is really important because there's a feeling now, particularly with the lesson of last year when Real Madrid had such a big lead. When Barcelona had such a big lead and Madrid came back at them. And as Barca could kind of see them approaching, they started to panic. Barca feel the same could happen to Madrid this year, not least because this is Madrid's second defeat away in a row. And they feel that's a sign of a wobble. Barca are about to get Samuletu back. Of course, is the guy that gives them aggression and edge and makes them competitive. And they think that Madrid may start to ever so slightly panic here, not least because Bernschuster has a bit of a habit of this. When he was at Levante, he and also at Jerez, his teams had brilliant first halves of the season and absolutely awful second halves.
That's very much the battle for the top, isn't it? Which means that the other clubs are now battling out for the remaining two Champions League spots.
Yeah, and the other clubs, obviously Villarreal and Atletico, are the two that have got it at the moment. And then the surprise for the UEFA Cup spots are Espanyol and Racing. But Espanyol and Racing now have a real challenge because bit by bit, Sevilla are getting better and better and better, and Sevilla are now closing in on that. I think they're in sixth place today. I'll have to double check that. They are indeed in sixth place today. And they look like they've got a UEFA Cup place, possibly even more. And Valencia last night, all right, it was only a 0-0 draw against Getafe, but it's the third game in a row without a defeat for them. And you get the feeling that Valencia may climb up and that Espanyol and Racing, those two teams who surprise everyone by having UEFA Cup places, may actually lose them.
So Barcelona are on the ascendancy. They've got Celtic. Kevin, how is Celtic doing at the moment? I mean, at home, Celtic pretty strong.
Yes, actually, the January window was used to good effect. They brought in some useful players, but more importantly, they scared the wits out of the existing team, who are now showing a desire to play for their places. They've scored 13 goals in three games. For example, they won 5-1 at Aberdeen, where Bayern Munich were held to a 2-2 draw. So, I mean, they're not a great team, but at Celtic Park, they've won six group games in a row at home. So they're quite formidable on their night before that crowd. Mm. I think Celtic will be hoping that if Etu does play, it's a half-fit Etu, because I think the defence may not be the strongest. But Gordon Strachan's done a formidable job. I mean, the Celtic are in the top 20 richest clubs in the world because of the European runs in the past couple of years. And that has been down to Gordon Strachan's clever acquisition of players.
Do you think they have any chance at all?
Well, they knocked Barcelona out of the UEFA Cup in 2004, but in those days they had some chap called Henrik Larsson playing for them, and other guys like Hartson and Chris Sutton and Neil Lennon. I really cannot see how they'll be able to keep Barcelona at bay in Camp Nou, no matter what happens at Celtic Park.
Sid, Barca hitting form at the right moment here for this, aren't they? And rightly favourites for the Champions League title.
Well, I think in a way that they're not really hitting form. As I say, they're getting results now. They're starting to show very tentative signs of improvement, but they're still not playing the way they were. And even those midfielders who even when Barca weren't effective, were playing lovely passing football, Iniesta and Xavi in particular, they've taken a little bit of a dip recently. And I think what's changed with Barca isn't so much the performances as the mentality. That said, I don't think they'll win in Scotland. I think away from home, they've still tended to struggle. Teams that have been aggressive against them have tended to get good things out of them. They've only won away from them, I think, four times this year in 12 games, which tells you something. Obviously, they haven't lost that much. But I think Kevin's right. The question mark is really what happens at the Camp Nou in the second leg.
Sid, Republic of Ireland Tyrol Aidan McGeady has been making headlines over here recently with some fancy footwork. Is he someone Barcelona would be worried about, you reckon, or will they be particularly concerned by anyone in the Celtic team?
Well, I don't think they'll be individually concerned by anyone, but because he's quick, he could cause some trouble, except that Barcelona have obviously swapped things around recently, and they're playing Carlos Puyol now at right back, and I think that's really improved their defence. And bizarrely enough, Barca's defence this year has been really very, very good. It's the best in Spain. They're playing very well. They protect themselves well. Victor Valdes is playing well in goal. So while McGeady in theory would cause them trouble because of pace, and they've been occasionally ropey at fullback, I think the new position for Carlos Puyol means that they probably won't be too overwhelmed by that.
He's quite intriguing, McGeady, actually. I mean, he does seem quite fast now, but he was known to be slow, and they brought in this kind of fitness guru bloke who's added some speed to him, which is something almost unheard of in football, getting faster.
What are we legend?
Because the actual out-and-out speed tends to be something that's natural rather than something that's strained or certainly appears to be. But I was watching him against Brazil, and I thought he was about the only person in the Irish team that did anything.
Mm.
go on, Barry. Yeah,
I was just going to say the jury seems to be still out on him in Ireland. Some people think his final delivery is poor and that he doesn't all, you know, he's a bit slow to release the ball, but others think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. So
yeah, I should mention you're not passing the ball. Gordon Strachan was always in the habit of saying the best trick is to give the ball to a teammate. And I think it was directed particularly at young Aidan, but I think the penny has dropped.
So just before we let you go, we've got a question from Dave in Madrid, who says, I assume at some point that you've met or interviewed Raul Gonzalez. He wants to know what your opinion of him is.
We could be here all day talking about an opinion of Raul. It's quite a difficult one. And to answer his first question, yeah, I have met him. And one-on-one, he's very, very likeable. He's a guy that when you ask him about things that are potential headlines or when he's in press conferences, he's famous for being little more than a walking cliche. It doesn't say anything. His spitting image puppet, for example, is like the Little Britain character, says yes, no, yes, but I mean, you know, well, yes, no, and he doesn't say anything. But if you go off the kind of, if you like, the spiky subjects and just talk to him about football, he's very, very interesting. He's very interested in other teams. He could tell you far more, for example, about Liverpool or Arsenal or Manchester United than most people in Spain can. He really does watch it, and he's really quite humble in that sort of environment. But within the dressing room is a slightly different issue. And he over the years has been very very put out, particularly by the Galacticos policy. And in this sense, I think I would share that with him. I think he's right to have been put out by it. He felt that the traditional qualities of Real Madrid were being undermined, qualities of sacrifice, of hard work, of training really, really hard for everything, fighting for every ball. But, of course, it just so happens that those are the qualities that he has in abundance. And there was a real sense of, I think, resentment towards some of the players, particularly Ronaldo, who he never, ever got on with. He respected Zidane because he was so brilliant. He respected Beckham because Beckham worked hard. But there have been a number of players who come to Real Madrid and had a terrible time within the dressing room. And I wouldn't go so far as to say entirely because of Raul, but Raul was big part in that. He played a big part, for example, in ostracising Nicolas Anelka when he first came. He played a reasonably big part in the ostracism, initial ostracism anyway, of Michael Owen. And as I say, he was a big part of the reason why there was a really important division within the Madrid dressing room during the Galacticos period. So there's a little bit of an arrogance about him in that sense, but it is based on his complete dedication to being a footballer. And in that sense, I think he's quite admirable.
Super, Sid. Thanks very much indeed for your input there. That's it from part two. We'll get more from your blogs and a little more discussion on the FA Cup coming up in part three.
I'm Alok Jha, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, we're here in Boston for the AAAS Science Conference discussing the future and safety of our food. Are you ready to start eating cloned meat and GM cornflakes? Also in the show, how close are we to discovering life on Mars? NASA's Stephen Squires from the Mars Rover missions details the next stage of exploring the red planet. Plus, inventor and futurist Raymond Kurzweil tells us why technology is going to save the world. It's all on the New Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
This is Guardian Football Weekly.
Welcome back to part three in the pod. Let's just remind you of the draw for the quarterfinals in the FA Cup. It's Sheffield United or Borough against Cardiff, Man U against Portsmouth, Bristol Rovers against West Brom, Barnsley against Chelsea. Are the tie of the round, Barry, for you is?
I wasn't really listening to you there.
How rude.
Yeah, sorry.
Can you read my writing?
I can't read your writing.
It's a
now
dreadful
either.
Scroll.
You look as if you might have been a duck. I suppose it has to be Manchester United against Portsmouth, really, doesn't it? But it's good that one of Bristol Rovers or West Brom will end up in the semi-final.
Yeah, Kevin, quick line on that.
Barnsley could repeat their feats against Chelsea as they did against Liverpool, but it seems a bit improbable.
Yeah, Paul?
Yeah, Bristol Rovers against West Brom.
Yeah.
Great.
It's a cracker. Thanks for your enthusiasm, Paolo.
I'm just still too enthusiastic about Sheffield United Middlesbrough to get onto the next round yet.
Okay, onto some blogs. Dun Wong asks, Barry, this is being posted late, but do you think at some point you could explain why, if Ireland has all this newfound wealth and there are lots of people that like football in Ireland, why Irish league football is never heard of anywhere outside Ireland? He says, I've found your discussions of the FAI intriguing, but often wonder where these players come from. To borrow from the Two Towers, one would almost think that Irish footballers spring out of the ground.
They don't spring out of the ground. They're not brought by storks either. But, you know, it's just natural. If you're good at football in Ireland, you tend to get picked up by an English club. The Aircom League at home, the standard is, I would imagine, it's probably about League Two standard, do you reckon, Paul?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair
enough. I used to go to a lot of Shamrock Rovers games when I lived back in Dublin, and, I mean, they were pretty poor, very poor standard. You do get some English old-timers going over to get one last, not lucrative payday, but, payday.
One of the reasons the standard is so low, of course, is not only because all Irish players go across to Britain. Most Irish fans go across to Britain. The average league attendance for an Irish club is under 1,000, whereas there's tens of thousands who come across to Britain every weekend to watch Liverpool,
one specific part of Britain.
The Irish Taoiseach, Bertie Ahern, is a man who refers to Manchester United as "we." You know, and comically in Ireland, you get you could have somebody from Galway who supports Middlesbrough slagging off someone from Mayo who supports Liverpool, calling them a scouse scum or whatever, and neither of them have ever been in Middlesbrough or Liverpool, so it is quite comical. But attendances at League of Ireland games are very low, and any good players we have go abroad.
Now that Trapattoni's in the hot seat there, Delaney and Roy Keane, is there still a little bit of friction there, or does Delaney care?
Oh, there's an awful lot of friction there. John Delaney is the head of the FAI, for anyone who doesn't know, and Roy Keane is not known for his love and regard for the FAI, and Roy Keane is always having little cuts out of Delaney. So now that Delaney has actually done something properly for once in his life, or nearly done it properly by installing Giovanni Trapattoni, he's come out and had a little cut back at Keane. He said, "I don't comment on the players that he's bought or where they are in terms of their league position." So a little snipe there about Sunderland's lowly position in the Premier League. But this is all very well, but the fact that Delaney looks and sounds like a character from Father Ted means it's very difficult for anyone to take anything he says seriously.
Nothing personal there at all, of course.
A stopped clock is right twice a day, so, he's bound to get something right for once in his tenure, and installing Trapattoni, hopefully, is the thing he's done properly.
Marvellous. Well, I'm glad he's got your vote then, Barry. Now, Thursday's discussion about the Championship also prompted lots of comments from the blogs. The best post came from the Feckless Chump, who says the idea that the best that many clubs can hope for is to yo-yo between the Premier League and the Championship prompted him to do some rudimentary research into survival rates. And this is quite interesting, if you like your facts and figures. He says, not including this year's new arrivals, 21 sides have been promoted since 2000. 12 of 21 have survived the first season. 9 of 11 have survived the second season. It's 11, apparently, because Reading haven't finished their second season yet. Of the 9 to have survived their second season, 4 can consider themselves established Premiership teams. That's Man City, West Ham, Blackburn and Portsmouth. Of the others, Bolton and Fulham have had 6 good seasons. So if a club survives the first season, they have an 80% chance of making it through the second and a 70% chance of staying put for several more months. Interesting, isn't it?
Well, no, it's not. I was struggling to keep up with you there.
Well, you need to sit in writing. There you are, don't you? And he says that given that Survivor is also worth anything up to £50 million, it seems that Sunderland have the right idea by spending a fortune in a bid to last that vital first season. Statistically, it makes them very likely to make it to the third and way beyond.
I mean, some of them, like Man City or West Ham or Portsmouth, money may be a factor in them staying up. But certainly, congratulations to Blackburn, who are not a rich club, but a big support. And even Bolton and Fulham, for example, despite Mohamed Al-Fayed, he stopped investing huge sums a while ago, apart from a little splurge this season. So I think the ones that you really have to praise would be Bolton and Fulham.
Yeah. Speaking of the Championship, it seems that Chris Cookie Coleman, who lasted 6 months in Real Sociedad, during which he turned up to a press conference 2 hours late because he claimed that his washing machine had broken down, only to admit later that he'd actually been at a student night until 5 in the morning. Yeah. New Coventry manager.
Yes. So
good move for Coventry, surely.
Good move for Coventry University. He didn't do a very good job at Real Sociedad, to be honest.
No.
And I was never that convinced by him at Fulham. So.
Were you not?
No, not really. I suppose maybe my expectations for them were too high, but I just barely staying up each year. And he never did anything that really floated my boat, I have to say.
I know a lot of Fulham fans who would agree with that. I know a lot of Fulham fans who are very unconvinced by him, although part of me does think that, well, now you look at it and have things really gone better since he left, so...
I mean, I know most managers like a whinge, but he is unbelievable. You know, everything is always somebody else's fault, the ref's fault, the chairman's fault. You know, he never seems to take responsibility for anything, unless it's being late for a press conference because he was out drinking with 19-year-olds.
You'd like to ask Ray Ransom why he thinks that he's better than Ian Dowie. I mean, what's improvement?
Oh, that's got a few blank faces around the table. Paul Doyle. I'd like your thoughts on that.
There they are.
as much thought as the hair on his head.
I think the pod on the whole is totally underwhelmed by the appointment of Chris Coleman as Coventry manager, which probably tells you all you need to know about Chris Coleman.
All right, gents. Coventry. Well, thank you very much. I think that's as good a place to leave it. Thank you very much.
One thing I want to ask.
Oh,
Robert,
go on, Barry. Yes.
I read somewhere recently that Sky presenters, of which you are one, you've been asked to sexy yourselves up a bit.
Have we?
Correct? Yeah.
First I've heard of it.
All right. Just the women.
It might be the women, but the women are quite sexy anyway.
They are very sexy compared to your rivals.
So is that pink shirt regulation issue?
The pink shirt, you see, is regulation issue. Yeah, everything, certainly in Sky Sports, is pink and blue. Everything. So I think we're out of time, guys. Thanks for that. Thanks for that very interesting question, Barry. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. We'll be back on Thursday. And when I say we, it'll be me again. I don't know where James is, but
he's on the piss.
He's on the piece. On the piece.
Yes.
Thank you, Barry. But we'll be rounding up the Champions League games on Thursday and look forward to the Carling Cup final. And meanwhile, if you'd like to have your say on anything in today's programme, go to football.guardian.co.uk. Click on the Football Weekly button. From all of us here, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.